The Association of Classical and Christian Schools presents Repairing the Ruins, the 2016 ACCS Annual Conference, copyright 2016. You may make additional copies of this recording for use by your school, but please do not sell any copies of the recording. Learn more about classical Christian education and the ACCS at accsedu.org.
All right. Good morning. Give everyone a chance to get a seat here. It's a delight to be back with you. This is my third ACCS conference. Look forward to it for months in advance. So thank you again for the opportunity to come speak with you. You just heard a powerful testimony from Dr. Oliver about standing for truth and righteousness and institutional integrity no matter the cost. It's about, as he said, obeying God rather than men. As an attorney who litigates religious liberty issues, this type of convictional leadership is absolutely critical to maintaining Christ-centered educational institutions in today's legal climate. We're walking through unprecedented times in America today, and it's both a sobering and also an invigorating reality. Sobering because this new sexual orthodoxy and unlimited personal autonomy poses a real existential threat to the existence of religious institutions, including Christian schools and including even churches. But it's also invigorating because with unprecedented challenges come unprecedented opportunities. We are the Esthers of our generation. We have been called for such a time as this. And it's humbling to think that God would entrust this cultural moment to us. All right, so let's not squander the opportunity. May he find us faithful. Since our last ACCS conference, we've seen many changes, to put it mildly, in the cultural and legal landscape. The first one that comes most prominently to mind, the Supreme Court's same-sex marriage decision late last June, where we had five unelected justices of the Supreme Court who discovered a new constitutional right to government recognition of same-sex relationships. They did not legalize same-sex relationships, by the way, because they were not illegal, to government recognition of those relationships. We've also seen an increase in what we call rights of conscience cases. We've seen county clerks, judges, and Christian creative service professionals that have either been sued or have been threatened with government punishment for not conforming to the government's orthodoxy about marriage and personal autonomy, and particularly the creative service professionals not wanting to participate in or celebrate events that they believe to be contrary to God's design for marriage and human sexuality. The bathroom debate has hit the national scene. Is this news to anyone? Okay. Target's genderless restroom policy made national news earlier this year, which has been followed by a number of public schools that have come out and said, students, you get to choose the sensitive areas based on how you perceive your gender identity rather than based on your actual biological sex. And, of course, the Obama administration recently issued its Dear Colleague letter to all public schools in the nation and private schools that receive Title IX funding, and they basically have given them an option. You either open your restrooms, locker rooms, shower facilities, overnight accommodation on school trips and the like to students based on how they perceive their gender identity, or we reserve the right to revoke millions of dollars in federal funding, much of which, by the way, goes to fund special education programs and school lunches, reduced school lunches for needy children. That same administration, of course, recently sued the state of North Carolina for enacting a law protecting students' bodily privacy and their right to bodily privacy. Well, what about developments in the Christian K-12 schools arena? I've counseled many of you, you being the Association of Classical and Christian Schools, who have received inquiries from same-sex couples. That's been probably the most common question that I have received in the past 12 months. Some of the questions we believe to have been sincere inquiries, others more likely to have been water testing, and there's been a tremendous amount of that has been going on. We've seen a couple new lawsuits against Christian K-12 schools, and I'm going to talk a little bit more about those a little bit later. And finally, we've seen resolution in a couple lawsuits against Christian schools, but unfortunately not as favorably as we would have hoped. Again, I'll talk a little bit more about that development in a moment. But before I do, I want to assure you of this. The developments have not all been bad. We have had some victories for religious freedom, and it's important to underscore and to reflect upon those victories as well. First of all, North Carolina did pass a privacy law, protecting and just affirming the right of students in the public school systems to use sensitive areas based solely upon biological sex. Okay, that's a win. That's a victory. Mississippi, the state of Mississippi, passed the most comprehensive conscience protection to date, period. There were some critics who weren't even sure that that was actually possible in a post-Obergefell same-sex legal climate. Okay, that's a huge win. But while we want to celebrate these victories, we also need to look with clear eyes at what's most likely coming down the pike. And we want to look realistically at the challenges that are facing Christ-centered educational institutions. We know that as passive cultural support for Christianity wanes, so too wanes the support for the autonomy of Christian institutions to maintain their religious identity and to make decisions based upon their religious convictions, especially when those religious convictions conflict with the prevailing views of right and wrong, as we know our views about marriage and sexuality do today. But winning cultural support does not affect our mission, but it does affect how we carry it out and what strategic steps we need to take to make sure our schools are in the best legal position they can be. So with that in mind, today we're going to talk about two things. First, the growing existential threat to Christ-centered educational institutions. We're going to talk about the nature and the magnitude of that threat in four specific areas. And then secondly, we'll talk about strategic steps that your Christian school can take to help protect its religious freedom. All right? Threats to religious liberty. There are four government laws or directives that I want you to be particularly cognizant of. Does not mean there are not other areas as well, but these are the top four as I see them in the current legal landscape. First of all, employment non-discrimination laws. Fontbonne Academy is a Christian K-12 school in Massachusetts, and it extended an employment offer to a food services director. But it failed to inquire about the food services director marital status while they were interviewing this gentleman. So while reviewing his hiring paperwork, the school realized that the gentleman had listed his husband as his emergency contact in his paperwork. And immediately recognizing the untenable situation between the school's religious beliefs about marriage and this individual's lifestyle, the school immediately started backpedaling, and it revoked its employment offer 2 days later. Predictably, that individual sued the school for sexual orientation discrimination in employment. Choosing teachers based on your religious beliefs is one of the most critical elements to maintaining a Christ-centered educational institution. Okay, it's absolutely critical to carrying out your mission of inculcating religious instruction to the students in your care. Employment non-discrimination laws threaten that mission when they prohibit your school from making any distinction among applicants or current staff members and teachers based upon sexual orientation and gender identity. Approximately 50%, just under 50% of states have a statewide ban on discrimination based on sexual orientation and gender identity, and most major metropolitan areas as well. For those of you who are wondering, on the state level, it's the common or probably anticipated culprits. It's going to be primarily your West Coast states, your Northeastern states, and your most northern Midwestern states that have these sexual orientation, gender identity bans. Again, most major metropolitan areas do as well. As it relates to federal law, and to make matters worse, the Obama administration is currently interpreting Title VII, which is the federal employment non-discrimination law, to ban employment discrimination based on sexual orientation and gender identity. In contravention of Congress's intent and every circuit court of appeals ruling on Title VII for the past probably 2 to 3 decades, the Obama administration's Department of Justice is putting all that precedent aside, and it's interpreting sex discrimination, what's rightly understood to be discriminating between men and women, it's interpreting sex discrimination to include discrimination based on sexual orientation and gender identity. Okay? That's currently playing out in federal court right now. So we should, within the next few months, I think, have a federal court ruling on whether the Obama administration will be able to get away with reinterpreting Title VII. But for our purposes today, I want you to understand that regardless of whether your state includes a non-discrimination provision that protects on the basis of sexual orientation and gender identity or not, your school needs to be prepared for one to exist. Because prominent LGBT activists are... They dedicated up to $100 million to pass these laws at all three levels of government over the course of the next 10 years. So your school, the bottom line, your school just needs to be prepared for one of those non-discrimination laws to be adopted. The good news, however, most employment non-discrimination laws include a religious exemption for religious employers. It's important we have to read the exemption very carefully because they vary from jurisdiction to jurisdiction, from state to state, and so on. Some of them are broad. If you are a religious institution, you're automatically exempt, and you don't have to worry, quote unquote, about these non-discrimination laws that protect sexual orientation and gender identity. Others are far narrower, however. For example, in the Fontbonne case, one very difficult aspect of that case in Massachusetts was that the Massachusetts religious exemption only applied to institutions that served co-religionists. Okay? What's a co-religionist anyway? And who gets to decide what a co-religionist is? That's a major problem because it means that the judges are going to determine who is a member of your religion and who is not. Okay? So just something to keep in the back of your mind. However, note that religious organizations have the strongest legal protection when it comes to hiring and firing individuals who have ministerial-type positions. So teaching religious doctrine, leading chapel, so on and so forth. Those individuals, you are going to have the greatest legal protection, absolute protection, regardless of the non-discrimination law at hand when you're making those decisions. All right? So employment non-discrimination laws is just kind of a very broad overview, but that's one major area that we need to be concerned about when thinking about religious liberty issues. The second one, public accommodation non-discrimination laws. Public accommodation non-discrimination laws are very similar to employment non-discrimination laws, and in fact, you'll commonly see them hand in hand in the law. So if you find your employment non-discrimination law, you're commonly going to find your public accommodation non-discrimination law as well. So what is a public accommodation? Typically, they are considered to be businesses or places that are open to the public and serve the public in some particular fashion. Now, does that sound like it should encompass a Christian school? What do you think? No, it really should not, should it? Christian schools are primarily private institutions. They're designed to serve and provide services to a particular segment of society, those who sign on to their statement of faith and are willing to come alongside them and partake in their mission. But those who are advocating for this LGBT agenda and proponing these rights are trying to apply public accommodation laws to Christian schools, including in the K-12 context. One side note, even if a public accommodation law does not clearly apply to your Christian school, we are still seeing situations in which Christian schools are being sued under these public accommodation laws, wrongly and falsely, and they eventually do win, but they've had to defend themselves in court against one of these laws, which again is just one of the major problems with adding additional protected categories to the law. You run the risk of incurring a number of frivolous lawsuits. Well, public accommodation laws can be problematic for Christian schools in two particular ways. There are two particular vulnerabilities under these laws. The first one is in school admissions, and the second one is in lifestyle-type policies. So public accommodation laws could try to tell your Christian school what criteria you may or may not use in school admissions, and particularly sexual orientation and gender identity. I'm only currently aware of one Christian school that has been sued under one of these public accommodation laws, and that was Hope Christian School in New Mexico. They received an application for a three-year-old child to attend their preschool. They eagerly processed the child's application. They said, we're finishing up your paperwork. We're going to get you enrolled here momentarily. Well, then upon reviewing the child's paperwork, again, they realized that the child had two daddies, and his home life was incompatible and inconsistent with the school's religious beliefs about marriage. So again, the school immediately began, are you sensing kind of a trend here? They immediately began backpedaling and said, we're so sorry, we're not going to be able, this would be an impossible educational relationship. And predictably, what did the fathers do? They turned around and they sued for sexual orientation discrimination under the local public accommodation law. And to my knowledge, that lawsuit is still pending. As I mentioned at the beginning, schools are getting a lot of inquiries, a lot of water testing going on, but we're not seeing a tremendous number of lawsuits as it relates to school admissions just yet. But that doesn't stop those who advocate for LGBT admission into every Christian school context from really making a big media splash about it. So how many of you are familiar with the Christian school in San Diego that was splashed across headlines last fall for declining a lesbian couple, their daughter admission to their kindergarten school? Did anyone see that? Okay, the lesbian couple was extremely vocal about looking for an attorney to sue the school, even though their lifestyle was incompatible and inconsistent with the school's religious convictions. In addition to school admission, lifestyle policies are another area of concern. So the question is, can a school maintain lifestyle policies, behavioral codes that are consistent with its religious beliefs about marriage and human sexuality? A public accommodation law could make unlawful behavioral policies that ban homosexual conduct, that have sex-specific wardrobe and attire requirements for boys and girls, or that restrict access to locker rooms, showers, and bathrooms based on biological sex. I am aware of one very new lawsuit against a Christian school because it kicked out a student for violating the school's lifestyle policies as it related to homosexual conduct. This complaint was just filed within the last month, so it really hasn't hit public airwaves yet, but you should just be aware that that is currently pending. But again, as we talked about in the employment non-discrimination law context, there are similarly religious exemptions in the public accommodation law context. And the second half of our talk, when we talk about strategic steps, that's where we're really going to dig into how do we best take advantage of those religious exemptions within the law, and then secondarily, any constitutional defenses that we have under the First Amendment. All right? So one employment, second public accommodation, the third, health insurance directive. And you heard Dr. Oliver talk about this just prior, about the HHS mandate. The Obama administration and some state governments are trying to force all employers, regardless of religious convictions, to pay for abortion-inducing drugs and devices, and in some respects, to pay for elective abortions as well in their health plans. So as he mentioned, the HHS mandate of the Obama administration trying to force organizations, including religious nonprofits and religious schools, to pay for abortion-inducing drugs and devices. And Alliance Defending Freedom had the opportunity of representing a number of the Christian universities that presented themselves before the United States Supreme Court in the Zubik case earlier this year, where we did receive a great win, 8-0, from the Supreme Court, telling the government, you need to find a better way. But don't stop with just looking at what the Obama administration is doing. I'm encouraging you to take a look specifically at your individual group health plans as well. For example, the state of California quietly issued a mandate that all group health plans must cover elective abortions in their health plans. What's particularly insidious about this directive was that it was issued essentially under the cover of night. A rogue government bureaucrat issued a directive to group health plans and instructed them not to inform the religious organizations whom they knew would have a religious objection to paying for elective abortion coverage. It was not until Alliance Defending Freedom was made aware of this change, and we then reached out to a number of our friends and acquaintances in California and asked them to read through their group health plans, that they realized that they were paying for elective abortion coverage. And there have been a couple of other states that have attempted to do so as well. So I encourage you on your to-do list for when you return home after this conference, take a good look at your health insurance plan and ensure that you're not unintentionally paying for a life-taking drug, device, or procedure that violates your school's religious convictions about life. Okay? Number four, tax-exempt status. This one is more futuristic. It's something that we need to have on our radar. We anticipate coming down the pipe within likely the next 5 years or so. The United States Solicitor General, when he was arguing before the United States Supreme Court in the Obergefell same-sex marriage decision, frankly acknowledged that the tax-exempt status of religious organizations would be an issue if those organizations adhere to their faith regarding traditional biblical marriage and human sexuality. Why would they revoke the tax-exempt status of religious schools and universities and other institutions? Because after Obergefell, your religious views on marriage are now considered to be contrary to public policy, and the government wants no part in, quote-unquote, subsidizing such bigotry. In their perspective. Whether or not it actually is subsidizing is an entirely different question for another day. But although the Solicitor General's comments related specifically to higher ed, Christian universities and colleges, the rationale readily extends to K-12 schools as well. So while we expect the initial tax revocation to start with colleges and universities, we expect that to then follow down the chain to K-12 schools as well. And then, of course, if federal income tax exempt status is revoked, the expectation is that states will then shortly thereafter follow suit, because commonly your property tax exempt status as a religious institution is premised upon your federal tax exempt status. Okay? Don't borrow tomorrow's trouble. All right, I want to encourage you, don't borrow tomorrow's trouble, but I do encourage you school administrators and your boards to be prayerfully planning for this, thinking about how can our school financially operate if our tax-exempt status were to be revoked, okay? What would it look like for our school? How can we stay afloat and start planning for that even now? I don't like to think in those terms, but it's good to be wise and proactive. Now, as a quick side note, I mentioned earlier the Obama administration's revocation of Title IX funding. It is already starting to go after K-12 Christian schools that receive federal funds and intend to maintain their religious identity and affirm marriage as the union of a man and a woman. Now, I'm not discussing this at length per se, because it's my understanding that ACCS schools, as a rule, as part of your accreditation, are encouraged or instructed not to receive any government funding. Is that accurate? Okay. All right. So we're not going to spend a lot of time there just because I don't see it as a major issue for you as a collective body. But do know, if you have other Christian school colleagues outside of your ACCS circles, be in conversations with them, because, again, we're already seeing lawsuits. One was filed within the last 3 weeks. Related to a Christian school whose funding for special ed programs, I think, and then secondarily school lunches for children who might not otherwise be able to have lunch during the day, is currently the matter of litigation because the school affirms marriage as the union of a man and a woman. All right? So these four areas, employment, public accommodations, specifically school admissions and lifestyle policies, health insurance, and then fourth, tax exempt status. These are some of the big areas of concern as it relates to religious liberty, as it relates to your Christian schools now, and what we anticipate being an issue in the coming months and years ahead. So I want to talk next about strategic steps to protect your Christian school. These are designed to help, number one, avoid a lawsuit. Okay? That's our prayer. That's our number one objective. We want to position the school in such a way that we're not creating incendiary situations. We want to avoid lawsuits if we possibly can. But if a lawsuit is brought to us, to secondly ensure that the school is in the strongest legal position it can be to defend its religious freedom and its right to maintain its institutional distinctives, affirm the union of marriage as the union of a man and a woman, and sexuality as God has directed us. Before we launch specifically into those steps, though, how many of you have already seen Alliance Defending Freedom's Protecting Your Ministry resource? Show of hands. Okay. All right. For the rest of you, actually, I encourage everyone, there are copies of the resource, free copies, on the back table. Please take as many of them as you like. We don't want to take them back. But they are designed to assist you and your school board and school administrators with proactively evaluating your governing policies, procedures, and so on to ensure you're in the best legal position you can be. For those of you who have either heard me speak in the past or who have already gone through the PYM, what I'm going to do today is we'll give a 30,000-level view of most of the strategies discussed in the PYM, but I'm going to particularly highlight a couple areas that schools either are not implementing well or are not implementing at all. And then a couple additional strategies not mentioned in the PYM related to public relations and public identity. Okay? So first of all, foundational questions. Before you even look at your bylaws and governing documents, I encourage you to answer two foundational questions. Number one, who is my school called to serve? Who is my school called to serve? Are you a discipleship-oriented school designed to come alongside intact Christian families and disciple their children in conformance with the parents' religious beliefs? Or are you more of an evangelistic school or a missional school designed to come alongside not only Christian families, but also families who may not agree with your statement of faith or those who may not be Christian at all? I hope it goes without saying that the answer to that question is neither a right answer nor a wrong answer. It's simply a matter of discerning what is your calling that God has placed upon your school. Who are you called to serve? The answer to that question is going to dictate how you craft the policies that we talk about in your bylaws. And you should also just be aware that given the current legal climate that we're in, schools that are more discipleship-oriented, those that have a narrower focus, a narrower group of individuals they're called to serve, will likely have the stronger legal protection. It should not be that way. And Alliance Defending Freedom will go to the mat for a missional school's freedom to serve even those that disagree with its mission statement. Okay? That should be your freedom under the First Amendment. But just with the current lay of the land, I want you to just be cognizant of the fact that those who serve a broader audience will likely have lesser religious freedoms in the eyes of the court than those who have a narrower focus. Okay? Secondly, second foundational question to answer, what do my school's religious beliefs require in the area of marriage, gender, and sexuality? You need to know before that same-sex couple calls whether it violates your religious convictions to have a child from a family background that is utterly incompatible with where you're trying to take your school. You need to know before you have a child who is enrolled currently in your school who says, you know what, I may have been born a boy, but I really don't feel like a boy anymore. I'm a girl now, and I want to use your girls' rooms, and I want to be treated like a girl and called by feminine pronouns and names. That's happened. That's happening now at Christian school. Okay? There's a lot of confusion that our culture is engendering with our children right now. You need to know, what is my conscience line? What can my school do? How far will we go, and what is the line we will not cross? Will we allow this child to use a sex-specific restroom? a unisex restroom or the restroom in the teacher's lounge? You know, how far will you go, and where will you say, I'm so sorry, this is not an educational relationship is no longer possible in this situation? All right? Having answered those two questions, let's move to governing documents. And I'm going to hit a number of these very, very quickly. They are covered in more detail in the Protecting Your Ministry resource. First of all, articles of incorporation. The first thing I look for in a legal audit is whether or not you're incorporated as a religious institution rather than an educational one. If you are not, it doesn't mean that I'm saying immediately go reincorporate as religious, but I want you to sit down with legal counsel and determine whether or not there's a reason within your state that it makes more sense to be incorporated as educational versus religious. And if not, just recognize that courts do look at the incorporation document to figure out if you're religious enough to take advantage of a religious exemption within the law and constitutional defenses. How you're incorporated matters. Secondly, a mission statement. Does your mission statement articulate a distinctly religious purpose for your existence? If your mission statement is primarily or only talks about educational philosophy or your classical bent in philosophy, you are not a religious institution. Okay? To take best advantage of religious exemptions within the law and First Amendment protection, you need to articulate a distinctly religious mission and purpose for the existence of your Christian school. All right? And we have some examples in the PYM about what protecting your ministry resource, what that might look like. Statement of faith. Very, very important document. First of all, it needs to be in writing. I'd like to see your statement of faith in writing. It doesn't have to per se appear within your bylaws. I get that question a lot. But a written document will suffice. Now, quick side note before we launch into what should be included. A number of schools and churches have asked me, well, we do the London 1689 Confession of Faith or the Westminster Confession of Faith, and we're not about to tamper with or change that historic confession. If that is your school's position, that's absolutely fine. What instead I want to see is a separate policy document addressing the issues that I'm going to be talking about, specifically marriage and gender. All right? However, if your statement of faith is not one of those historic creeds, I much, much prefer to see marriage and gender seamlessly inserted within an existing statement of faith. Why? Because I feel like as a separate policy document, they commonly attract unwarranted attention to themselves. You're not a one-issue or a one-belief school, are you? All of them are important and critical, and you're going to make school decisions based upon all of the religious beliefs listed in your statement of faith. All right, I'd like to see them as one cohesive document, preferably. First of all, marriage, okay, goes without saying in today's day and age, you need to have a definition of marriage included within your statement of faith or policy document. There is a sample provided for you within the Protecting Your Ministry resource. Most schools have either done that or in the process, but the big one they're omitting is a statement on gender and sexuality. In light of Obama's transgender directive, the target issue, and just the growing prominence of gender identity and transgender issues in our culture today, I think it is essential for every Christian school to have a definition of biological sex or gender, a statement of belief about these issues within their statement of faith or policy document. It doesn't have to be long or unwielding. It can be something as simple as, we believe that God has wonderfully and immutably created each person as either male or female, and that these two distinct complementary genders together reflect the image and nature of God. From this statement of faith and policy document will then emanate any school policies related to attire for men and women, for the use of sex-specific restrooms, locker rooms, and shower facilities. Okay? Very important. In fact, Alliance Defending Freedom is currently litigating a couple of cases related to the transgender and gender identity issue. And what has been critical for us in proving our case is the organizations having a written statement of belief about biological sex. All right? Moving quickly, please, in the PYM, be sure to take special note of the statement on life. Again, if you happen to be within a state that is trying to mandate that you cover abort-efficient services. It's very helpful when we're fighting back against the government for you to have a written statement of belief about life. Moving from governing documents, let's talk about school policies. First of all, employment. This is another big area that I see and I find to be lacking amongst many schools. Written employment policies. Please have them in writing. It's particularly important that every employee read your statement of faith and sign a document stating that we affirm, we hold to these beliefs, and we are willing to be bound by the religious beliefs of the school. That's excellent evidence for us if it becomes necessary for the school to then terminate a particular employee for a lifestyle or behavior that is inconsistent with the school's religious convictions. In the Protect Your Ministry resource, also please read with particularity the section talking about ministerial employment criteria. I encourage you, all of your teachers should be praying before classes. They should be required to inculcate religious instruction into the classroom. If you are a distinctly religious organization, religious institution, religious instruction and doctrine should permeate every aspect of your identity. And I think if there was one comment that encapsulated the best strategy to protect your religious freedom, it is that. Your religious identity must permeate every facet of what you do. Lifestyle and conduct policies. Sorry, I'm going to move through these very quickly. We're getting close to the end of our time here. But behavioral standards. It's important to have written behavioral standards both for students and for teachers. In particular, we would encourage you to comment on no intimate sexual conduct outside marriage as the union of a man and a woman. And if you have dress standards, this is a great place to just highlight that we expect young men to dress like young men, young women to dress like young women, and this is actually grounded in our beliefs, Genesis chapter 2, Matthew chapter 19, that God has created the sexes distinct, complementary, and immutable. They're not subject to change. As it relates to facility use, there's a detailed facility use policy in there for your use if you allow any outside groups to use your facility. What I'm most concerned about today is whether or not I would encourage you to consider adopting a physical privacy policy. This is something a little bit new, something we have advocated for in the public school systems for quite some time and are just encouraging Christian schools to consider it. This is a policy that basically says, based on the school's religious beliefs, all sensitive areas, including the restrooms, the locker rooms, the shower facilities, and all overnight trip accommodations, if that's applicable to your school, are to be accessed solely based upon one's biological sex. Again, grounded in the school's statement of belief about gender and biological sex. Now, I commonly get a little pushback because that sounds a little bit weird, and it just feels a little strange to even have to articulate that, does it not? But here's some factors I encourage you to consider if your board is weighing whether or not to adopt one of these policies. Think about the types of facilities that you have on site. What types of facilities do your students, teachers, and any outside individuals use? Do you have multi-stall facilities? Are they single-stall facilities? Do you have locker rooms and shower rooms? Those I see as the more vulnerable than a multi-stall restroom would be per se. So that's one consideration. So what are our actual physical facilities on site? The second question is, do you engage in athletic programs such that you have outside teams that come on site to your school or any other major programs where you would have outside individuals coming to your class or your physical school facility? I think that would counsel in favor of one of these policies, especially, again, if you've got athletic programs, where you have locker rooms and shower facilities that are an issue. But always, if you adopt such a statement and a policy, ground that in your statement of faith. Quickly, public identity. So moving on from governing policies to public identity, it is absolutely critical that you publicly identify as a religious institution. Be boldly religious in your public identity, in your website, in how you portray yourself to those who are inquiring about your school. Highlight any affiliation with a church or religious denomination. You'd be surprised that that helps. Courts take note of that type of affiliation. Publish your statement of faith on your website. For organizations, religious institutions that tend to hide their light under a bushel and hope that, you know, well, maybe people will just think we're just a classical school, but, you know, not really a religious school. That is dangerous territory as it relates to taking advantage of your religious freedom protection. Finally, public relations. This is a new area that I've been talking with more and more Christian schools about because it seems to be a greater and greater issue, especially within the last 12 months or so. Two components to this. I encourage you, you need to have a plan in place for when you receive that inquiry from the same-sex couple. I don't say if, but I say when, right? So you need to sit down and have a conversation with your staff, with your administrative assistants who answer the phones. Okay? You have those inquiries directed to one designated person or to your board of directors or the like. I'm not so concerned with who needs to answer that question, but you do need to ensure that your staff is strictly instructed not to answer that question. All right? If there is sufficient time, I encourage whoever the designated party is to contact Alliance Defending Freedom. All of our services are for free. We're happy to even, I've done it a number of times, I'm happy to walk you through what's the best way to respond to each individual inquiry. There is no formulaic response. You need to know that up front. If there isn't time, though, I think that does, or, you know, if it's at an open house and you have a family member or a parent approach you, you need to have prepared a response grounded in your religious convictions and make clear that an educational relationship would be impossible because we are not a good fit for you. Okay? So think that through. Secondly, you also need to have a plan in place for when the media comes calling, and they do come calling. I don't know how many of you saw the news reports related to Davidson Academy and Trinity Academy. They were two Christian schools, again, within the last probably 2 to 6 months. Both of them were the subjects of media firestorms because it was made public that they adhere to beliefs about marriage as the union of a man and a woman, or they had informed a same-sex couple that an educational relationship would be impossible, and that same-sex couple then went to the media. They were crucified in the media. So what I want you to do is sit down with your board of directors. You need to have a conversation about how we're going to handle this. Again, you are welcome to contact Alliance Defending Freedom. We have an entire PR department, a media department, that's happy to walk through that issue with you. But most importantly, do instruct your staff, never, ever respond to a media ambush. All right? If you have reporters showing up on your door, you don't have to answer the questions. You're under no obligation. You're welcome to say, please call us later. We're happy to set up a time to talk. And in the interim, contact Alliance Defending Freedom or another public relations firm to have that conversation. But you can actually do damage to your legal case. Statements that are made off the cuff or by someone who has not been trained in how to respond to those statements, all right, they will be recorded and they can and will be used against you in a court of law later. So be thinking proactively about how you can respond in love and compassion when these types of situations arise. And again, feel free to let us know. Okay? So in conclusion, Christian schools have an uncertain destination, but there is still much that you can do proactively to take advantage of religious exemptions and constitutional protections within the law. And I just want to encourage you, Alliance Defending Freedom is here for you. We have over 60 staff attorneys and a network of over 3,000 allied attorneys across the country who are here and ready to help you in your school for free if you ever encounter a situation that challenges your freedom to live and operate according to your religious convictions. All right? Unfortunately, we are out of time. I apologize. I intended to leave some time for questions, but I'll be around. Feel free to let me know if you have any questions. I would love to talk them through with you. All right? Thank you so much.